With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Hey everyone, Beyond the Baseline is brought to you by FanDuel, the leader in one-week fantasy sports. More winners, more payouts than any other site. Enter the promo code BEYOND at FanDuel.com. Enter a risk-free tournament. Get back up to 10 bucks. We're also sponsored by the SeatGeek app, the smartest way to buy and sell tickets for your favorite events, sports, concerts, theater. Download the SeatGeek app. Enter our code BEYOND for $20 off your first purchase.
I think tennis is one of the best sports in the world. A lot of people are playing, but I think, unfortunately, not a lot of people are following. And that's just something that I think will need to change. Somebody who is ranked number 10 or 15 in the world, if he walks in a New York City outside of the U.S. Open, it's very unlikely he'll be recognized, while somebody who plays for New York Knicks will be highly recognized. So I think there's definitely something that you need to bring tennis closer to the people.
Everyone, John Wertheim here. Welcome back to 2016. It's the Beyond the Baseline Tennis Podcast from Sports Illustrated. We're going to start to get these going again before Australia. Next week, we will preview the Australian Open with Lindsay Davenport. And by having Mai just said that and memorialized it, now she has to do it. This week, though, we have another former player. Great guy, New York resident, former top 10 ATP-er. Former vanquisher of Roger Federer at Wimbledon, no less, Mario Ancic. How are you?
Hi. All good.
How do you feel
happy
about
New
being
Year
our first
to everybody.
Guest? Yeah, happy New Year to you as well. We're recording this first week of 2016. Where are you?
I'm currently in New York. I'm working in investment banking in Credit Suisse. So I'm in cold New York currently.
How long have you been on the job now?
I'll be in a while. I graduated last year from Columbia Law School, and as soon as I graduated, I moved here. So I've been in New York now for 4 years.
You like this town, don't you?
I do. I really do. Great friends, great experience, tons of sports. So it's pretty good.
So you are 31 years old. And it's been a while since you've been out there playing, but I'm looking at these ages, and you're younger than a certain Swiss player who's still out there. You're younger than David Ferrer. You're about same age as Stan Wawrinka. Does it cross your mind to give tennis one more shot? I mean, how far removed are you from saying, "Boy, I was a top 10 player not that long ago"?
It's been a while. It's been a tough transition. But I have to say it's as hard it was when the doctors told me I have to stop with professional sports and move to something else. I have to say now, looking back, it's been almost, I would say like almost 7-8 years, going to the locker room these days and talking to all my friends, as you mentioned, who are still playing. It's fun because I can say that I played with the best. I played with all of them. I beat some, I lost some, but I would say I'm proud to be a part of, I would say, one of the most successful generations in the history of tennis. And also having a chance to move into something else and having the experience of going back to school and working in New York and Wall Street. So when I look back, there are some times that when it was extremely sad and tough to understand why everything happened the way it did. But then, he also gave me opportunity to meet tons of other people. And after all, also, do something else and live in New York.
If we loosen up your arm a little bit and give you 10 serves right now, how fast are those coming in?
Oh, I can still hit it pretty hard. I'm still in a pretty good shape. So I can crack something around that. With few serves, I think I can go back to serving as I serve full. The problem is just repeating it at 7-8 hours.
Yeah, exactly.
That's an issue.
Right. I remember. Didn't you tell me that you were? Tell me if I get the story right. But did you not warm up or hit with Djokovic before he played in the Indian Wells final last year?
It was before Indian Wells finals, and then also before the U.S. Open finals.
And you got out there on the practice court and still hit around with him.
Yeah, I've been hitting with him. I even hear some people in the crowd calling Mario if I'm coming back. Unfortunately, I didn't come back.
I was going to say, how did you respond to that?
It's fun to hit with a friend before such a big match.
And you're still friends with a good number of the guys out there, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm pretty close with most of them still, yeah.
So let's keep talking about this transition, because I know the ATP has held you up and is understandably very proud of how you made this transition from being a top 10 player to you're still in your late 20s and you have a law degree and you're going to law school at Columbia. Is that something that seemed natural to you? Was there a point where you said, you know what, my tennis career sadly is going to be over before I want it to do and I need to think about what's next? I mean, how did that even come about?
No, it was much more by chance than me planning anything. Obviously, with my injuries and my illness that I had, it's been basically told to me by doctors that I have to start looking into something else. That unfortunately, my body anymore can deal with things that you have to deal as a professional athlete. And that I had to start looking for a new career. So obviously it was a hard hit at that time. Basically dedicated 15 years of my life to, playing junior tournaments in Croatia, working hard, working your way up, becoming a pro, playing Davis Cup for your country, winning Davis Cup, becoming one of, top 10 player, and still being, one of the youngest top 10 at that time. Everything kind of stopped from one moment to another, and it was a difficult thing to deal with that. But I think I was extremely lucky and extremely blessed to have chances and after my tennis career and meet the right people that were guiding me together with my family and in learning what's the next step for me, because that's what's happening for, that's the step that you need to do as an athlete, because it's one of the shortest career ever. Obviously, I was planning to do it when I was 32, 33 years old.
Right, right.
Now I have to do it when I was 25, 26. So as I said, I was very lucky and blessed to have people who were giving me good advices and telling me to go to grad school. I did my undergrad back in Croatia, and I was looking whether I do my JD degree or do my MBA degree, but something that I would obviously help me to make that transition. And I did my JD at Columbia. I had amazing 3 years where I was sharing classroom with one of the smartest people in the United States and abroad. And it was definitely an incredible experience. And put me in a position to, to do other stuff as well.
So, are you practicing now, or you're full time in banking?
I work in banking full time.
Well, why'd you choose banking over law? Curious.
It's not as you're working still on the same kind of transactions, so it's very transaction orientated. We're working on multi-million dollar deals. The only thing is, I just find banking was a little bit more business orientated and a little bit closer to the clients, understanding some other set of skills that I felt would be very helpful in future. I think it's very helpful to have a legal background understanding and how to structure a deal, but also having that business experience, being in the boardroom and understanding how much do you pay for a company that we're buying, what are the assumptions, what are the growth of the company, and how to work with the numbers was something that I felt would be very beneficial to my future.
So when athletes go to work in corporate America, a lot of times we hear that the teamwork is a strength, and they know how to set goals and perseverance. I mean, there are all sorts of virtues from sports that carry over. But I'm curious for you, what's been the hard part? I mean, what's something that you didn't get as a professional athlete that you had to learn in your late 20s, early 30s?
I think like a lot of the things that you have is those intangible things that you can't really touch, or you don't see straight away. But as you mentioned, like dealing with pressure, hard work, perseverance. But something that you have to learn is the substance of your work. And I would say, as you work day to day in TV or writing, like you got to master, or when I was on the court, you got to master your day to day work, hitting a lot of balls and figuring out the tactics and working on your shots. That's the something that now, you have to take all these intangible things, but which will help you in order to master your new craft. And that's basically the transition that, a lot of athletes, and I know a lot of them that are on Wall Street or in law firms or in corporate America, they are using all those intangible skills that you already have. But now it's, you're not hitting balls anymore. Now you're trying to figure out how to buy a company. And obviously that's a set of skills that are very specific, and that's a craft that you have to master now.
You see The Big Short?
Actually, I'm going to see you next few days.
I won't tell you how it ends.
No, please don't.
Go see it. All right, let's take a quick break to pay some bills. The NFL regular season is over. Roughly a quarter of the league's head coaches now are unemployed. And what about you? How did your fantasy team do this year? You know what? Don't even answer that, because season-long leagues are so old-fashioned. That's for another year. This year on FanDuel, play for cash all the way up to the Super Bowl. You can also start a listener league, compete with your friends, play on FanDuel.com, use the code BEYOND. And your first tournament is risk-free. What do we mean by that? Any contest up to 10 bucks. If you win, you keep the money. If you lose, don't worry about it. They'll refund your account. FanDuel's the best place for one-week fantasy football. Building a team is easy. It's fun. Pick your players. Stay under the salary cap. Entry fees start as low as just a buck. If you take a week off, take a week off. Think you know fantasy football? Come prove it on FanDuel.com. And again, use the code BEYOND to sign up now. It's right in the upper right-hand corner under the microphone. Here's the offer. Enter a league, and if you don't win, no worries. FanDuel refunds the money. That's any contest you want, up to 10 bucks. Andy Dalton gets hurt during a game, no problem. Sign up for FanDuel.com. Use the code BEYOND. Again, make the deposit. Choose your league. If you don't win, you get the money right back in your account. Sounds like a pretty good deal. The only way to get in on this offer, though, is to go to FanDuel.com, click the microphone, and use the code BEYOND. So you wrote a thesis in law school, ATP, yesterday, today, and tomorrow. What is the ATP of tomorrow look like? From a business perspective. I mean, how do you assess the ATP as a business?
Yeah, I think so. I did my obviously I was in New York. I was very involved in while I was studying, I was involved in different sports, I would say, particularly on a business perspective of NBA. And I would just say from as a business person now, I would like to see, obviously changes in tennis, which I think the main one would be how to bring obviously more people to have that experience, of, you know, feeling what the main athletes are feeling. You know, I think it's been a huge transition in the NBA or NFL when, you know, coaches and players have mics. So you know what they're talking about. You feel when they're stressed. You know when they're, you know, what they're saying. If there's any trash talking, like, or you had those in the locker rooms when the coach is talking before the big game. And I think the way that, you know, television is such a powerful thing, and I really, really appreciate you and everybody who are around tennis and the media, but I feel players would need to take that step as well, and understanding you guys are our friends and we are in the same business and trying to get as many people to watch, get more exciting, you know, add more things. I think tennis is one of the best sports in the world. A lot of people are playing, but I think, unfortunately, not a lot of people are following. And that's just something that I think will need to change. And I would just, you know, draw the line of, you know, somebody who is ranked number 10 or 15 in the world, if he walks in a New York City outside of the U.S. Open, it's very unlikely he'll be recognized, while somebody who plays for New York Knicks will be highly recognized. You know, I feel there's tons of work to be done. I think it's super exciting sport. I think it gave me so much, and I know there's tons of people who love tennis and who play a lot of tennis as an amateur here in the city. So I think there's definitely something that you need to bring tennis closer to the people.
So if you went in the ATP locker room and you said, we're going to put microphones on the court and the fans need to really get a sense of what it's like during the match, top 20 guys, how many of them are agreeing to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there has been some pushback in the past, but I think you know, the guys who are now in the role of deciding, I think they're very business savvy, and if you know, I think the way that they come methodologically and use their time to master their craft, I think if there are people who can explain them why are they doing and what are they trying to achieve and how that's going to reflect on their you know, on prize money, on revenues, on sponsorships, etc. I think that you know, players would be more than happy to you know, to make some adjustments. I mean, I would just say, you know, it's that as powerful as it is TV, I think there is such a huge growth opportunity for sports in particular, because it's the only one of the only contents that you have to watch live these
exactly.
days.
Exactly. No one DVR sports.
Exactly, and if you look at it, there's, so you know, there's Netflix. If you want to watch shows, you watch in your free time. But if you want to watch live, if you want to watch finals of U.S. Open, there's only one moment where you're going to watch it, and that's live. And I think that's something that, you know, sports is taking advantage of. I think tennis is still a little bit behind all the major U.S. sports. And I see, you know, in the future of, you know, that would be the step that they need to take. I will also add, tennis has the huge international component, such as the NBA, because it is one of the most recognized international sports in the world. And I just feel there's plenty of opportunities, and you know, I feel that, you know, there could be a lot of good things done.
So, what do you think of this idea? We have players from the United States who are playing in the U.S. and in South America. There are only three time zones. The flights are not particularly long. We'll put more events in the U.S. The players in Europe will play European events. Players in Asia play Asian and Australian events. Everybody comes together at the four majors. Three regional tours. Everybody comes together for the slams. Yay or nay?
I mean, It's kind of like already that's almost the way it is now. I mean, it's not as very stringent and regulated, but it, you know, almost it is. I mean, if you look at it, everybody are in Australia now. after that, I mean, I used to play the European circuit indoor, and most of the European players were there anyway. Most of the U.S. guys were playing, you know, Memphis and San Jose, and, you know, Scottsdale, that before Indian Wells and Kibitkin, and most of the South Americans and some Spanish guys were playing clay.
Sure.
So I think there is already, you know, maybe as not as, you know, stringent or official as you mentioned, but there is already similar, you know, situation happening, and in current, you know, in current ATP schedule.
That's interesting. Let me, if as long as we're talking business, if a tennis player makes $100 at a tournament, $1,000, what, $10,000, and by the time it's taxed out, and maybe his management company takes a little bit, and he's paying for his travel, how much of every $100 do you think a player actually keeps?
Well, I would just say that there is such a misconception about tennis, that tennis players are, you know, earning, you know, millions and millions and millions of dollars, because obviously Roger and Rafa and Novak are so marketable and doing so well. But you go a little bit down the list, and I would just say that unless you're, you know, regularly top 30 or 40 player in the world, it's very hard for you to make, you know, a good amount of money of living. You know, now we're comparing, obviously, you got to compare apples to apples, and, you know, apples and oranges. Obviously, if you put tennis versus weightlifting or tennis versus rowing, yes, you get paid well. But if you put tennis as top five sports in the world, together with basketball, you know, together with soccer,
yeah, sure, even golf,
as it is,
right?
Yeah, as in golf, it's not even. I mean, it's not even close. It's really, really far. As a player who is as an ex player, but somebody who still comes to a few events, few tennis tournaments a year. I'm talking to all the players. As you mentioned, they're all my age, a little bit younger, a little bit older, and there is a huge there's a huge income inequality, if you want to say it in a more political or business jargon, and there is really, really huge discrepancy of the top guys and lower end guys, and in general there is you know, as I said, like, unless you are really top 30 or top 4 in the world in tennis, it's really, really hard to make a living. There's no more sponsorships deals as they were maybe 10, 15, 20 years ago. You know, it's definitely much, much harder to make money. And on the other hand, your team, because it's becoming more competitive, your team now has like 2 or 3 or 4 people. Where before you know if you probably had just a tennis coach, now you have to have a tennis coach, a physical trainer, a masseur, and, you know, and a part-time nutritionist for you to come, because it is so competitive, because everybody are investing in themselves, in their career. But obviously that means that, you know, your profit
becoming
shorter and shorter.
Is there anything we can do here, or is this just the market is what the market is? I mean, can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you.
Yeah, so is there any way to correct this? Is there any way to address this? Or is this just the invisible hand? I mean, this is just the market acting the way a market does, and it creates these inequalities. And is there anything that can be done correctively?
I mean, as I said, like, obviously one of the big things is try to grow the sport. You know, you feel by growing the sport, I mean, you know, getting those people and followers that are paying the tickets, that are paying the channel, that are coming, you know, that everything helps, because then the players get marketable. There's more money on the table, and that's the first step. That's what you see in the NBA, NFL. That's the something that, you know, that's what they did, and that's why they've been growing exponentially. for, you know, for the last 10, 15 years, and I would like to see tennis doing doing more. As you know, like recently the NBA announced the biggest TV deal in the history.
Right.
Obviously, you know, players are taking some pay cuts. You know, if there was a free market, who God knows how much LeBron James would take, but there's a salary cap, which means it's distributed more equally. There are a lot of, you know, tennis is individual sport, and there are some unique things about it, but I feel there's also a lot of things that we can learn from other sports and follow the example of the main, you know, and put tennis where it does belong, and I think that's top five sports in the world.
And you worked at the NBA one summer, didn't you?
Yeah, I did.
So you saw this. Are you friendly with Tony Kukoc as well? Who's, I think he's from your hometown, right? From Split.
Yes, Tony, and he's from my hometown. And Dino Raja is from who played for the Boston Celtics. He's from Split as well. So we have a really strong tradition of basketball. So yes, I've been following basketball same as I follow tennis. That's why it's such a unique experience for me to go to Madison Square Garden, or because I remember waking up at 3 or 4 a.m. in Croatia during the wartime. We barely had a signal, but you know, followed MJ, Scottie Pippen, and Kukoc played for the
right.
Bulls, playing Knicks with Pat Ewing and John Starks and you know, Pat Riley's team from the 90s. So that was watching that as a kid, and now being able to, you know, go almost like a few times a month, it's special for me.
Hey everyone, it's Wildcard Weekend in the NFL. It is also tennis season. We've got some Australian Open tune-ups going on the other side of the world, but these four NFL games, they're going to be great. But don't just watch on TV. If you live in the relevant market, SeatGeek is the best way to find your ticket. Hey, you in Houston, Texas, Cincinnati, Minnesota, and Washington, D.C. Yes, really, Washington, D.C. The Redskins actually are in the postseason. Download the app. Use the code BEYOND, get $20 back from SeatGeek, and actually go to the games. Here's how it works. It's very simple. Download the app again. Enter the code BEYOND, make your first purchase, and SeatGeek sends you $20 back via check or PayPal. SeatGeek, again, like Kayak for airline tickets, pulls all the options out there and puts them into one conglomerated place to buy and save you time. SeatGeek allows you to know the fair market value of every ticket, and then it helps you find the best deal. Again, you want to go to some NFL games this week. It's very easy. Download the SeatGeek app, enter the promo code BEYOND, and SeatGeek will send you back $20 once you've made that first purchase. NFL wildcard, some college football title game, good concerts. I suspect if you were in Australia, you could even use SeatGeek app to get in on some tennis. SeatGeek app, enter our code BEYOND, get $20 back. If pro football is your game, the MMQB podcast gets you ready for Wild Card Weekends with Robert Klemko, Andy Benoit, and now our new Grantland hire, Robert Mays. They're all in the NFL podcast. They've done two special episodes, a Star Wars extravaganza with Chris Conley of the Chiefs, and a three-city tour of St. Louis, San Diego, and Oakland, any one of which, or two of which, could lose their team to L.A. by next season. The MMQB podcast, find it on iTunes, Stitcher, or si.com/podcast. You know, I think a lot of Americans learned about conflict in the Balkans through Kukoc and Vlade Divac. And they made a 30 for 30, and it was always a big theme of in the 90s. Croatia and Serbia, and it was sort of animated through these two athletes. When you're a Croatian player like that, did you have a sense of what people did or didn't know about your country? We were talking about this. I'll tell you, we were talking about this with Djokovic, saying like everybody understands Roger's from Switzerland, and it's the Alps and chocolate and watches, and everybody knows Spain. But Djokovic says, "I'm from Serbia," and people don't necessarily have a great concept of what that country is all about. Did you feel that way coming from Croatia?
Yeah, I mean it's a very similar upbringing that you know, all of us from ex-Yugoslavia had, because Yugoslavia has been a country for many years. So people abroad, you know, if they knew about it, they knew it by the name of Yugoslavia.
Right.
And then all of a sudden now there is, you know, Croatia, Serbia, Slovenia, like God knows how many countries, and it was very confusing for a lot of people who were, you know, following those conflicts, because they first of all, it was, you know, far away, if you were living in States or Australia or Asia. And then secondly, there were just so many new names that you were just trying to figure out what is who and what's happening. But I was just, you know, and it was difficult, because, you know, you always felt, you know, that you need to, you know, promote your country, and you need to explain what it is, and you need to, you know, say where it is geographically.
Yeah, right. I mean, right, exactly.
But I would say now it's Croatia has been known for one of the best touristic places in the world. I'm very proud of it. Every year I organize a sailing trip with a bunch of my friends from school. I think there has been like at least 100 or more people from Colombia going to Croatia in the last few years. And then also in New York City, there's a lot of people who either they left, went to Croatia for summer, or some of their friends, or they heard, or it's been, you know, in New York Times and Wall Street Journal, they wrote very nice things about it. So
right.
People see it as a great destination now to go and have a vacation. And I feel that's you know, together with a lot of athletes, which was, you know, Croatia was very recognized of, it's something that brings people there, and then they can start learning about, you know, how old the towns are and the whole culture and history of that area.
Exactly. I always feel like it's sort of an overlooked part of Djokovic, though, that he has to, you know, people don't necessarily understand his homeland and his country, and it's sort of another burden that he carries that maybe Murray and Federer and Nadal don't have to. Let me ask you, if people, I think you say to the average tennis fan, Mario Ancic, and they probably, first of all, I suspect, would say 2002 Wimbledon. Do you agree with that?
Maybe. I mean, it's tough for me. I think I had much more other success, and I think coming to top 10 is
that was my question.
21, 22.
Exactly.
But I would say probably it is something that opened the door for me to the tennis world.
Right. But I was going to say, so obviously that year you beat Roger Federer. Federer, of course, wouldn't lose again at Wimbledon for, you know, six more years. But I always feel it's different that athletes don't always perceive their career the way fans do. I mean, when you look back at your career, what do you want to be recognized for? What are some of the highlights to you?
I mean, highlights for me was definitely, you know, being part of, you know, being a solid part of top 10 while I was, you know, 21, 22, which today's standard seems like extremely young. And there was the whole career for me, but I was already there. So that's something for me that I am extremely proud. Obviously, not knowing where my peak would be, because its peak is usually 27, 28, 29. I never had a chance to play it that late. And then something that I'm really, as a Croatian, proud is winning a Davis Cup and winning the Olympic medal. Those are things that, you know, I look back as something really important for me, for my country, as we mentioned, coming from a small country is a way, being an athlete is kind of a way of being an ambassador and promoting to the world. So I feel those few things would be something that I hope fans, you know, recognize me and, you know, when they hear my name, probably that's something that rings the bell.
And now they hear Credit Suisse too. You won the. Tell me if I'm wrong here. We do this podcast with no notes, but you won that Olympic medal with Roger Federer's coach. Did you not? Am I right on that?
Yes, I did.
With Lubitsch.
Yes, I did.
What do you think of that? What do you think of that arrangement? We're talking about Lubitsch and Federer, obviously. What do you think of that arrangement?
I'm not surprised. I think even I know him really well. He's 5 years older than me, but I remember him. My brother played with him in a Croatian junior team, so I know him basically since I was 12, 13. He's extremely hardworking guy, and very dedicated to the game of tennis. He achieved a lot. He was ranked number 3 in the world. We were, our fates kind of went together in winning the Davis Cup and the Olympic medal together. So we stay close, and there's something that kind of bonds us together. So I know him well, and I think this is a great thing for Roger. They are really close friends, Roger and Ivan. And they have been since Ivan played. So I think that's something that obviously Roger now needs at this stage of his career. Somebody that, understands him, somebody that is close to age to him. But also I think somebody who will bring that, current tennis experience, because Ivan played against most of them as well.
Right.
So I think that, experience that Ivan had and basically playing with all the current top players, is something that I think could be very beneficial for both of them. And as I said, also at this stage of Roger's career, I'm sure he needs somebody who also understands him, who can confine him, who needs a friend, and they've been really close for a lot of years. So, wish them luck, and I think it will work well.
All right, last question: how many majors is Djokovic winning in 2016? You got 5 choices, 0 to 4.
Yeah, we're obviously talking that he's healthy and then he doesn't have any injuries throughout the season.
Yeah, that's a good point. But let's assume if
everything goes well and there's no any ups and downs regarding his health, I see him a favorite in all 4 slams, and I would say that he will he will win 3.
So same as 2015.
Same as this year.
You want to speculate which one he doesn't pull out, or you want to just stick with 3?
I don't know. I feel Roger has one more in him. That's maybe just my feeling. I could be wrong, but I feel like Roger is still the man to beat, and I would obviously Wimbledon has been his backyard and somewhere where he feels the most comfortable. So I would say
interesting.
I would say Roger could win Wimbledon.
I like that. All right, this is great. You're outside. It's cold out. This was terrific. We'll have dinner after the Super Bowl, but thanks for doing this. I'm going to Australia to get warm. I wish you were still playing, but sounds like the working world is treating you well.
Corporate America is treating me well. Thanks a lot. I'll be working hard here in New York. In my free time, I'll be watching Australia. I'll be
get up early.
And I'll envy you for having that warm weather there while we're freezing here on the East Coast. And I'll be following. I'll be a number one fan. I still have people telling me when I was home for Christmas, and they ask me, my friends and my coworkers. They're like, what do you do when you're home? And I said, I play tennis. With who? With people in the club. And they say, you're still a tennis fanatic. And I am. I mean, I just am. I'm a, I breathe and live, tennis still. I follow it with my heart. I'm there as a number one fan. And, it's great for me to still see my friends doing so well.
We need more of you. Go make a killing at Credit Suisse and then come back to tennis. But that was great. That was a pleasure. I'm going to go into the warmth for a few weeks and then we'll reconnect. But thanks for doing this. This was great.
Okay.
All right. Take care.
Take care, Jim. Bye-bye.
All right, everyone. That was Mario Ancic, Croatian former top tenor, all-around good guy, only 31 years old. He is now an investment banker at Credit Suisse. He will do just fine for himself, but maybe he'll end up back in tennis one day. That's our first podcast of 2016. We'll have more to come. Lindsay Davenport is coming next week. We'll try to do a few of these from Melbourne. Have a good week, everyone. See you in 7 days.